Any one thing you say or do, or the effect you have on someone, can have a major outcome or result for them in their life. I've grown to try to be more careful about how I treat people, the words I use, trying to be more compassionate and look at things through different lenses. We're all kind of one big conscious, and we can all feel each other's shoes in different ways depending on the day. So, not trying to judge people because I might be wearing your shoes tomorrow.
Welcome to Salish Wolf, a podcast bringing you inspirational stories of extraordinary endeavors. I am your host, Todd Howard. Just south of my Vancouver Island home is a tiny archipelago on which for nearly a decade lived a most astonishing animal, a lone wolf. Takea, as he would be named, survived and thrived in an environment where likely no wolf had ever set foot. In the process, he captured the hearts of a community and showed us even the most unlikely is possible. His story is not dissimilar to those of the individuals interviewed on this podcast. At some point, they each had to turn to their inner lone wolf. From there, they were able to lead and inspire. My intention is to share their journeys to help you discover your own inner greatness and peace. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor Point Expeditions, where I provide life-changing personal leadership retreats for men, coaching, and other valuable personal growth resources. Visit anchorpointexpeditions.com to see where your journey could take you. Terry Bullman has been a fighter most of his life. As an only child growing up on a farm in North Carolina, he used to watch martial arts movies and dream of fighting like Chuck Norris or Bruce Lee. He began training on his own, and then with clubs and gyms, to earn black belts in Taekwondo, Karate, and Krav Maga. He eventually made it to the ring, octagon, and mat as a competitor and started winning his way into bigger venues and fighting in different disciplines. With 16 years as a professional fighter, Terry has experienced the sting of pain, the sweetness of victory, and the humbling of defeat. He takes us on a journey of his fight career, sharing both the highlights and the lowlights. We discuss The Human Weapon, a popular television series on the history and efficacy of martial arts around the world that he created for the History Channel. And he shares his why for his newest pursuit, which is helping men live fuller, happier, healthier lives by becoming more balanced. Just before the global lockdowns that changed everything for many of us, Terry and his wife made their own decision to change everything by purchasing a retreat center on the Pacific coast of Costa Rica. Even though they were locked out of the country for much of the first year of ownership, they kept the dream alive and now run an incredible boutique hotel and retreat center. The Balanced Man is a passion project to Terry's that has now come fully to life and will hold its first men's retreat this October at his center. With its manifesto of freedom through discipline, the Balanced Man retreats offer a combination of physical and emotional experiences to help men break through into their best lives. Terry practices what he teaches, and through his example and leadership, he's having a profound impact on men. Please enjoy this episode of Salish Wolf with Terry Bowman.
Yeah, you are in space. It looks a little weird. You're just like floating out there like a astronaut.
Oh, dude, bro. Take a little couple mushroom chocolates and off to space we go.
There you go. I miss you, man.
Miss you, bro.
How's archery going?
I went one day and I needed the other arrows. I finally got those from the guy, so now I need to glue some up. Yeah, it's just not the same without you being here.
I know, man. Nothing's the same. How'd you get into archery?
I actually grew up on like a 100-acre farm just outside of Asheville, North Carolina. So not much to do. Only child, and had to entertain myself. So, and I used to love, you know, watching Robin Hood and all the movies when I was a kid. So there was a certain type, these certain little trees that grew on my grandfather's farm. And I figured out pretty quickly that they would bend and not break. So I decided to make a bow out of that, and I would make my own arrows off the branches. And I mean, I'm talking like arrows with no weight on the end or no feathers, but they would still shoot good enough in short range. So I mean, that's how I learned to shoot. That's why I told you, that's why I cantered my bow, because I was just holding it on my hand, and my hand was small, so I would have to turn it to get the arrow to stay. But yeah, man, I've loved it for a long time. I've had that bow I brought back to Costa Rica for like 20 years, just holding on to it like, oh, I'm going to go hunting with that, or I'm going to, you know, get a range and shoot that. And of course, very little of that has actually happened, but was able to get that down here, and I'm excited about having a couple of bows to practice with. I want to make it part of my weekly routine, where I'm at least shooting once or twice a week.
I think we can do that, man. Every day.
Yeah.
Let's do it every day. Yeah, the bow, the big one I'm making right now, it's probably sitting at about 85 pounds. I've done a few test draws on it. Yeah, I'm not going to keep it at that. It's like, I want it to be a workout, but I also want to be able to enjoy it and not get injured. So
yeah,
I'm getting the bow string for it today, and then I'll shave it down and get it to a weight that feels more comfortable. But I'm excited for it.
You use a specific kind of wood for that, yeah?
Yeah, it's U-wood, Pacific U.
Wood.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can make them out of a lot of different things. Osage orange is a big one. And then there's a lot of hardwood you can use as well. But U's the only one I've worked with. So that's what all like 7 bows are that I have. And I just started on another one just to get a head start on it.
Yeah. What are you making the tips with?
So normally it's with horns. And like one of my bows has water buffalo. Another one is, I think it's called a kudzu, which is an African kind of gazelle-like thing. But
I'm already shaped, or do you have to?
No, you got to shape them. But what I don't have here, other than I have goats, but none of my goats with horns have died. So I don't have any of their horns yet.
You know, there's an easy way to solve that, right?
I know. I've been talking about it because we still have 11 goats, and they're not much use other than mowing the grass, but we still have to feed them. And we had one die last year, but he was our only goat that had been dehorned. And once we saw him get dehorned like 8 years ago, we're like, there's no way we're going to dehorn any goats. So I've got like a never ending supply of bow tips when some goats start to pass. But on this one, I got some white oak, which is a really hard wood. And basically just sand down both surfaces so it glues on really nice at the end, and then you shape it. So so we'll see. Hopefully it works.
Okay.
It looks good.
You're going to have some strong-ass glue if you've got an 85-pound
pole. No, because it pushes it, the way the wood is shaved down, it presses against it. It's like kind of two plates pressing against one another. So no, it doesn't put any... There's no fulcrum or anything that's going to cause it to pop off. Yeah, it's all in the skill, the artistry, man.
Math and science. I got you.
So archery obviously is not your only passion. I mean, you have been immersed in the human body and how the human body can be used, as your History Channel show was, as a human weapon. So like, go back, take me back. When did you first get exposed to martial arts, fighting, whatever it was that was your inspiration that got you involved?
Like I said, man, I was a lonely, only child. So a lot of, you know, watching movies and TV shows and then going out and trying to imitate a lot of those, you know, I loved Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee and all those guys growing up. I was just always fascinated with it. And I was, believe it or not, I was the smallest kid in school most of my life. And I just you know, I wanted to play football, I wanted to do sports, and my parents, for whatever reason, just said, no, you'll get hurt, we're not going to do that. And so I didn't play any sports. So I would just go out in my backyard and I would practice my kicks. I wanted to be a ninja. You know, I would order the magazines and it would have like the tabby shoes, you know, in the back with the split in the toe and the throwing stars and like the claws you put on your hands so you, and feet so you could climb trees. Like I was a bit of a nerd. I'm sure you could see that. But and then when I, as soon as I graduated high school, I joined an ATA Taekwondo school. And, you know, I loved it, started competing, ended up getting my black belt in Taekwondo within, I want to say, 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Just because when I walked in, like I could already, I'm literally training for this my whole life.
You're already a mini Bruce Lee.
Yeah, I was, so I could do a lot of the moves and stuff already and fell in love with the competition side of it, but only the sparring. So in ATA, you had to do, it was mandatory that you do forms in order to spar, forms or kata in order to spar. So I hated doing kata. So I would basically bow in and do one big punch and then bow out. That was my
that was your cat. So,
yeah, I would get all sevens, which is like the worst score you could get. But I didn't care because all I wanted to do was fight. So I went, ended up going to Worlds in Taekwondo, and then I think I injured my knee from doing like hook kick, ground kick combos and things like that. And so I switched, and I went to a tough man contest. They have those in Canada?
I think so.
Back in the day, like Bad Man, Tough Man.
Yeah.
Like Art Gore had a promotion called Tough Man that, you know, especially in the South was a big circuit. And, you know, you've got the gloves, the Everlast gloves that you just like slip on over your hands that have hardly any padding in them, and headgear, and guys would, it was 3 1-minute rounds, and you can imagine in one, you know, 1 minute, which is actually longer than it sounds. A minute is a long time
when you're getting your ass kicked or trying to kick someone's ass. Yeah.
But yeah, so I saw a guy do that, and you know, I went to one of those events, and then I just thought, man, I would really like to do that. And I ended up meeting a guy, Pat Donovan, who was like an old school boxing coach. So he started teaching me how to box for these events. So I ended up winning the event in my hometown at the Asheville Civic Center. And it's a funny story because I ended up fighting this like giant guy the first year. The first year I fought, I didn't win, but it's really what made me a fighter, because I fought this guy, you know, I think we were in the finals or going to the, it was the fight to go to the finals. And this guy had muscles on muscles. He was like, you know, 6'3", 230 pounds, just ripped. And, you know, I'm in there and the crowd's going crazy. And the guy knocks me down. It was the first time I'd gotten knocked down. I was like, oh, I mean, he drilled me. And I get up and, you know, I go back in and he knocks me down again. I mean, every time he hit me, basically, he was knocking the crap out of me. And the second time, I was done. I was like, no, that's good enough for me. And the ref looked at me and said, do you want to continue? And I shook my head, no. And he just pushed me back in. Like, oh, like I don't know if he thought I was saying, no, I don't want to stop. But I definitely wanted to stop. And so he pushed me back in. And then when he pushed me back in, I ended up knocking this guy down. And it just became like a back and forth battle that went the distance. And I actually, the guy ended up winning the fight, but I broke his collarbone.
Oh, shit.
With the punch, and he couldn't continue. So the last two guys fought, but we ended up getting a trophy for the fight of the night. And just, you know, like I said, I was the smallest kid in school growing up, wasn't very popular with the girls, was, you know.
Not much so has changed, Terry.
I know. You know, rub it in. But just the adulation that I got, and, you know, everybody came up after the fight. Oh, man, that was the coolest thing ever. And so that was it. I mean, even though, I mean, really, that ref turned me into a fighter. Because had I stopped, had I quit,
yeah,
and, you know, it'd been the end of it. It might have been the end, and I would have went on and maybe done something, been an accountant or something. But
so how? Probably not. What size were you then? Were you still tiny?
No. I started lifting weights when I was 16. I remember being was like 5'6", 135 pounds. My junior year in high school.
Yeah.
And by the end of the year, I was like 5'7", 145, but I benched, like, my junior year, I benched 245 at 145 pounds.
Damn.
Literally all I did was bench press, because if you, it doesn't take much for me, Todd. Just give me like a t-shirt or a prize, a trophy. So you got these shirts. We were the Blackhawks, and if you bench 200 pounds, you got like a shirt that says, you know, 200 pound bench club, you know, Iron Hawk. And so, yeah, man, that's literally all I wanted. The 250 shirt my junior year. I think I only got to 245. I mean, I literally benched every other day. And I'm doing all the tricks, all right? I got my feet on the bench. You put a big pad on the bar, and then you, like, bridge your back up. Like, I'm doing everything possible to do this. But I fell in love with working out. I was, you know, I was super impressed with Arnold Schwarzenegger and all that. So I was really big into working out. So at this time when I'm fighting, I mean, I'm, you know, 195, 200 pounds. I graduated high school at 5'9", 160 pounds. And by the end of the next summer, I was 6'1", 190 pounds, 195 pounds.
Wow.
So late bloomer. But so, I mean, I'm a big guy, but this guy, yeah, some of these guys were monsters, because there was no cap. You were either, if you were heavyweight, there was no limit.
How'd you break his clavicle?
Overhand right.
Ouch. Did you feel it?
I was trying to hit him in the face, and I hit him in the clavicle.
Oh! Did you feel it break?
No, I mean no. I mean, it was, you know, you're fighting and just swinging, and I mean, you know, especially early on, it was. I'm sure it wasn't a beautiful, crisp, clean punch that hit him.
Yeah.
But that fight. So the next year, I came back. I had trained for that, and I ended up winning. I won the event the following year, and then I was hooked and started fighting in tough man contest all over. You know, I would travel and do it. So I ended up winning, I think, 7 events, and they told me that I was no longer considered an amateur and I wouldn't be able to compete anymore in those events. So at the time I was living, I got married and moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, and was training with a coach named Ace Miller for boxing. And I thought, you know, the next gradual progression would be to go from tough man to amateur boxing. I found out that because I had been paid money in tough man, that I wasn't considered an amateur in boxing, which is ridiculous
Damn rules.
because
So stupid.
some of the best boxers in the world are in the gold, you know, are in the amateurs, you know, and tough man certainly wasn't on that scale. So anyway, so I immediately turned pro without any amateur fights other than the tough man events. So this is where my eight broken noses came from, in case you're wondering. In the beginning, man, it was tough just because it was, I mean, I was training and fighting with really good Golden Glove boxers. But, you know, I trained, and I had my first fight. My first pro fight was Harris Casino in North Carolina. And it was on like a Sugar Shane Mosley card. I mean, it was big. And I'm like, man, I have made it. I am, you know, signing autographs. I'm in this casino, like, and I'm straight off the farm. So this is a big deal for me. And I ended up, you know, I weighed 197 pounds, and I fought a guy that was like 250. But he was like 0-2. So he wasn't that skilled, but he was big. And you know, the gloves are a lot lighter. We're fighting in 10-ounce gloves opposed to 16-ounce gloves. You're not wearing headgear. So all these things are new. So I end up fighting the guy, and I mean, man, his punches are so hard. But he's real wild. You know, he's kind of like the tough man. He's throwing wild punches. And he threw a right hand. I leaned back, and he ended up coming up from the floor with a straight left arm, caught me on the chin. And when I wake up, the ref is standing over me, and he goes, nine.
Oh shit.
And I remember thinking, it's like, oh, they must count backwards in the pros.
Oh shit.
They do not count backwards in the pros. I had lost 9 seconds of my life. So, you know, I lost, and I was just totally defeated. I lost my sponsor. I had a sponsor, so all I was doing was training and fighting, and lost my sponsor. So then my coach, we for a year, I literally did nothing but work defense because I really had no defense. And tough man, I would hit them, they would hit me, and you know, I just had a hard punch and a good chin, and it worked out. In the pros, you couldn't do that. So I ended up training for a year and then had my second fight a year later. Ended up knocking that guy out in the first round and had, you know, so I was 6-2 as a pro, as a heavyweight pro. I lost my first one and my last one. Then from there, you know, I got knocked out in my last pro fight. I hadn't trained. It was hard because, you know, I had my kids and I was driving and traveling and you know, working and then still trying to fight. And I have a lot of friends, you know, in the UFC and stuff now. And I mean, they are the fighters. That's their job. That's their career. They're professional fighters. So they don't have to go do a 9-to-5 and then train. And, you know, they've got massage therapists and, you know, trainers and chefs and all the stuff, you know, that really, if you're going to be competitive, that you need. So from there, I was working still. I was teaching martial arts at what was then was East West Karate that turned into Premier Martial Arts. So after that, I got offered a kickboxing fight, And that was in Dalton, Georgia. I went down and had a kickboxing match, ended up winning, and the coach said that I should try out for the World Combat League, which was the Chuck Norris League on Versus. So we put together a little, I don't know, audition reel and sent it in, and they accepted me. And the first fight was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, the last fight I had, I was a boxer and had gotten knocked out. So this was like a year and a half later, but I had been training and working hard, and this was a big opportunity. I was super excited to get to fight in front of Chuck Norris. I mean, I grew up, like I said, watching his movies and idolizing him. And so we get there a few days before, and you have like the weigh-ins, and you have the face-off, and because it's televised, and the guy that I'm fighting is, 6'6", 250 pounds, and his name is Wrath White. I'm like, what the? I was like, who gets this kind of draw for their first fight? So, I mean, you're facing off, and all the hype, and the guys, like him and his friends, are just snickering the whole time, and like I'm scared to death, honestly. But I'm there, and I've been in a lot of I've had a lot of fights by that point, so I'm like, whatever, I'm gonna go out and do the best I can. And so we come out, and I come out first, and for the World Combat League, there's the smoke and all that, and the guy, he comes out, and we're on teams, but you have individual fights. So I come out, and then he comes out, and he points at me across the, we fought in this like pit, and he points at me across this pit, and he like does a throat slash. I'm like, you mother. So the guy, for some reason, it just flipped a switch in me. It really pissed me off. And so as soon as the bell rang, like, and because it was like a team event that wasn't over after you went, like you didn't touch gloves and do any of that. Like it was just like go time. So when I came out, like I mean, as soon as I got in range, I threw the hardest jab I could throw. Ended up catching him right on the chin and stiffed this guy in the first punch. He goes down. I mean, shocked him, shocked me. The crowd goes crazy, and then he gets up, and the ref asks him if he's okay. And I mean, he's looking in my direction, but he's not looking at me, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like he's not there. So yeah, I ended up knocking him down two more times. Finally knocked him out at the end. The ref wouldn't let him continue.
Nice.
And that was my World Combat League debut, and just really put me back on track of like, man, this is what I'm meant to do. And that was 2007, 2008, maybe 2008. Then I was training and traveling for the World Combat League. I had another event. I ended up getting hurt holding pads for one of my guys. He did a double leg. I was holding pads, and he was doing takedowns, getting ready for an MMA fight. He ended up rolling my ankle. So for the next event, my bunk mate was Pat Barry. He ended up fighting those fights, and then right after that, for whatever reason, the World Combat League disbanded. So, that was kind of my biggest thing in fighting. I made the most money. It wasn't a lot of money, but I made the most money. It was televised. And then I thought, well, we'll give MMA a try. Even though I had no jiu-jitsu, no wrestling, I trained a little bit, and I ended up having my first MMA fight, and it was in Trump Marina. I don't know why, or maybe because I never had like a good promoter, but like my first fights were always like my first pro boxing match was at Harris Casino on pay-per-view. My first pro kickboxing match was the World Combat League on Versus. And my first MMA fight was at Trump Marina on Go Fight Live. Like, it wasn't the UFC, but, you know, there was no, I never had really a chance to, like, get my feet wet with some, like, smoker, you know, with some smoker fights, less pressure. It was always, like, for me, oh, man, spotlight. So I have this MMA fight, and it wasn't even my coach, he was my boss at the gym that I worked at. And I said, man, I'm going to do this MMA fight. I said, I think I'm going to drop to 185 pounds. And he starts laughing because at the time I weighed like 225 pounds. Was working out a lot, big, and then eating a lot too. And I was like, why are you laughing? He's like, bro, you can't drop to 185 pounds. I was like, why not? He goes, dude.
Because that's 40 pounds.
Well, yeah. And he said, I love you. But he said, you're either going to eat it, fuck it, or kill it. Like, you don't have the discipline, like, to lose 40 pounds in the next. Because the fight was in, like, 8 weeks. So, of course, there was the challenge, and I was like, all right. So I end up losing the weight, which was, you know, I mean, I was eating salads. Jeez. I'm in the sauna in a trash bag, you know, just, I mean, I killed myself to get down to 185.
Wow.
But I felt like, I mean, the guys, because the guys the guys in UFC and all those guys then were like draw. They were cut. That's how they cut. They cut like exorbitant amounts of weight. I mean, I've seen guys drop 20 pounds in a day for a fight.
Wow.
You know, but they used to be allowed to replace it with IVs. But anyway, so I get there. It's in Atlantic City, and I get there. And I mean, I'm like emaciated. The guy comes in and he doesn't make weight. So they ask, hey, this guy weighs 190 pounds. Would you still be willing to fight him? And by that time, it's like, you know, you've trained, your friends and family have come out to see us. Like, yeah, let's fight. And we come out, he's a boxer wrestler from Detroit, and we come out and we start fighting, and I start catching him with some leg kicks, and I'm like, all right, you know, my stand-up, my kickboxing was better because that's where I came from, and he ends up taking me down. And at that time, I didn't have very much jiu-jitsu, but I'd learned this scissor sweep. And I end up, he's got me down, and I end up sweeping him, and I have him mounted and with his head on the cage. And I go to hit him, and it's like the bad dream you have where you're like fighting in peanut butter or something, and you can't really punch. If you try to punch and you can't, you know, you're like stuck and you can't really punch. That's what it felt like. I don't think I could have broken an egg with my punch that day. And, you know, I found out later, regardless, I tried to hit him a couple times, had nothing on it. He walked up the cage, mounted me, and I mean, elbowed me in the face till the ref stopped it. So again, defeat. But I found out later that I I had, because I had dropped to 185 and then he couldn't catch. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go try to put on as much weight as I can before tomorrow. So, and the weight's over, so I can eat whatever I want. So I end up from eating salads and water and doing a water cut for weeks. I go to the Hooters and in Trump Arena and have like wings and appetizers and sweet tea, and I mean, I just crushed it. So 2 hours after weighing 185, I weighed in at 198.
Holy shit.
So in my mind, I thought, oh, that's good. I've given my body back what it needs, and I'm going to kill this guy. But what I really did was totally screw up all my insulin levels. You know, that's my ATP storage, everything. So when I got in the fight, I felt good. I felt fast. But as soon as a little bit of cardio started, I was done. So that should have been the end of my fighting career, but it wasn't. There would be long stints, right? I would think I was done and, you know, I would go back to working or teaching or whatever, and then I would get an opportunity to fight. And I always had a hard time saying no. But trying to think after that fight when I started, because I had kind of done jiu-jitsu some for MMA. I had trained a little bit with different coaches that would come through town. But I started fighting or training in jiu-jitsu. Trying to think. No, I had one more fight. I had one more kickboxing fight. It was a Glory Rules kickboxing match when I was 40. I want to say I was 40. I think I was 40 or 41. And I hadn't fought in since that MMA fight. Been like, I hadn't fought in like 7 or 8 years. But I was training and felt good and great shape. And I was like, man, I want to go out on one more fight. And I had this Glory Rules kickboxing match with a guy that I think we caught at like 195. Again, I had to lose weight, but I got in really good shape. I trained hard. This guy was a good MMA fighter, but wasn't a kickboxer. I was like, I'm going to have this fight. I'm going to win. I'm going to be done. I'm going to go out, you know, on my flag. And Todd, it was the weirdest. It's one of the weirdest things that's ever happened to me. I came out into the cage. I was the main event. Ended up being the main event because the main event guys got hurt. So we ended up turning into the main event. In my hometown, I mean, I've got hundreds of people there to watch and support me. My kids are there. I get out there, and as soon as I walked in the cage, my oldest son said, he told us, like, he's not there. Like, my dad's not there. Like, it was like the weirdest, and I'm not making excuses. I mean, I've won a bunch of fights and lost a bunch of fights and knocked out world champions and been knocked out by guys that were like 4-24. So the ego part of it for me, like, he won, but I almost felt like I'd been roofied. Had this feeling of just like not in my body. Like I was out, it was like an out of body experience. And I don't remember, I only remember one specific kick, the leg kick that I threw in the fight, and he checked it. And I was like, oh, I remember it hurting. But the rest of the fight, I have no real recollection of it. He ended up knocking me down like 3 times, and they stopped it at the end of the first round. But I just remember getting in the cage and feeling like I'd been roofied.
Yeah. Crazy.
And I think it was just sensory overload from not fighting for 7 years, and
Yeah.
maybe old age, I don't know.
Nah, you're not old, dude.
You're not old.
You're
I'm
not old.
so at that point, I promised my kids I was done fighting. I had a long career. I know it sounds like I lost a lot, but I really only lost, four or five fights over my career. It was just always seemed like the crescendo of I'm either going to go to the next level,
Yeah.
or I'm going to stop, and I would get knocked out or beaten in big fashion, and that was kind of my like, all right, not going to the next level.
Yeah.
So then, at some point, I opened my own gym and facility for Krav Maga in 2000. Well, that would have been 2008. I started doing Krav Maga in 2001, when I worked at East West Karate, that ended up being Premier, and trained with Darren Levine, that was with Krav Maga Worldwide. And just fell in love with it. The practical aspect of the self-defense, the use of boxing and Muay Thai kickboxing and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and then putting it into a military system, just, I mean, it really resonated with me. So yeah, I got my first teaching certificate for Krav Maga in 2001, and taught, for, well, I'm still teaching, but I ended up opening my own studio in 2008. Had it for close to 15 years. Just recently closed those, but at some point, started training jiu-jitsu, and then the jiu-jitsu, this he started doing jiu-jitsu inside of my studio. And I had always been resistant to it. I was a stand-up fighter. I thought, oh, I'll catch him with an uppercut coming in. I'm not worried so much about going to the ground. Even though I had been exposed to, I fought in a in the one of the tough man contests. I ended up doing a super fight. I won the tough man, and then one of my buddies was Spencer Fisher, who had a pretty good career in the UFC. He was supposed to have a super fight with a guy, and the guy backed out. So they asked me to do it. They paid us $150 each, to fight each other.
Man, I thought you were going to
And
say grand.
no, man. I mean, in fighting, especially like coming up when I was coming up fighting, you made no money or all of the money. There was no in between. You were a champion, boxer TV, and you were making hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, or you were getting paid, even in the fight in Trump Marina in Atlantic City, it was 500 to show and 500 to win.
Right.
Just not, you're not, wasn't doing it for the money. And so had done, so I fight Spencer, and I end up, I'm so much bigger than him, and I'm hitting him, and he ends up getting me in like a rear naked choke. I couldn't swallow for like a week. He was doing jiu-jitsu before anybody had even heard of jiu-jitsu. This was like the first UFCs with Royce Gracie, and so I knew that, jiu-jitsu worked. I just, for whatever reason, was resistant to it. And my timeline's all screwed up, but because I as I'm thinking back, I did the human weapon in 2007, 2008. I trained at a different gym, and I trained a guy named Stephen Land that owned a production company at the time, and I pitched him this idea because I'd always loved martial arts and always been into martial arts, and pitched him this idea of traveling around to different countries and studying the martial art of that country, and you know what it would be like to have a fight at the end of you know train with like a master, and then have like a fight at the end, you know, with like a competition at the end with either him or his best student. And he loved the idea. He pitched it to History Channel, and they ended up picking it up for 17 episodes. Wasn't life-changing money, but it was an incredible experience. I got to, you know, go to Greece and study Pancration, which Pancrase has been going on since, which is was basically boxing, wrestling, and kickboxing, in the Olympics, with rule sets, in 636 BC. So combat sports has been around for a long, long time. And, you know, that show, the fight with Wrath White, like all of that, you know, started materializing into me getting the gym and a little bit of accolades for that, and the other place that I got to go was Vegas to do the MMA episode. I went to Zuffa and met Dana White. I got to go to Big John McCarthy's gym. I was the MMA fight that the guys were watching. I got to do all the motion capture for the human weapon, which is like the computer generated guys that were demonstrating the moves, put on like a mocap suit. They actually ended up using one of those in the movie Limitless. Do you ever see that movie with Bradley Cooper
I
where he
think
takes the
so.
pill and he's super smart? Yeah, I was
It's
in
really
the
old,
theater.
right? Yeah, I don't know. I think
Yeah,
so.
it's pretty. I was in the theater, and there's a scene where Bradley Cooper is surrounded by guys. He's gonna have to fight him, and he's like, "I don't know how to fight." But then he had taken the pill, and he's like, "But wait!" And then it starts showing, you know, all these scenes of Bruce Lee and all this, and then there's a cut of one of my motion captures where I'm kicking the guy's legs out from under him. And it's maybe a second and a half, and I'm like, holy shit, that was me.
You didn't know, you had
And
no
it wasn't
idea.
even, oh no, I had no idea. I mean, you know, once you sell the show, you sell all the rights. But so I had no idea that it was in there. And I mean, it's like a computer generated guy, so it's not like it's my face, you know, I'm wearing a suit or like a mocap suit, so it's just two you know, skeletons fighting each other basically. But that was me, and I was like, I'm in a Bradley Cooper De Niro film, kind of a big deal, people know me.
Just
So
moved up in
that was
my books,
cool.
man.
Oh yeah, right, I thought so. I was so low, that was easy. It was an easy step up.
I first met you in jiu-jitsu training, of course, and you have a few pounds on me, let's just say, and a few inches, and quite a bit of experience on me, but even though you could take down anyone in class typically quite easily, like what I was always so impressed by with you is just your humility. And you showed up every day with this like gentle grace that made it so easy for other people to be around you. And I know that despite our size difference, I was always so happy to see you in class because I knew not only were you not going to kill me, because you just knew too much about what you were doing and you didn't have the ego attached to it. But I also knew you were going to teach me, which was great. Like my first ever jiu-jitsu class, I was near my 40th birthday and there were only like 10 people in class, and there was a brown belt who was probably about 200 pounds, and I'm there in civilian clothes, very clearly my very first jiu-jitsu class. And we go through some probably an hour of learning some techniques, and then we go to roll. And the sensei basically says, you know, let's focus on what I was just teaching you, those techniques or whatever it was. Let's work on that. And I think I rolled maybe with one or two people, and then I get to this guy. And in about 4 seconds, he wrapped me up and dislocated 3 ribs. And I and I was just like, what the fuck? Like, why did you just do that? And so I was out. I was out for like 3 months. That was the start and potentially the end of my jiu-jitsu. But I eventually kind of got, you know, got the ribs put back into place and started to heal and decided to try it again. And I'm glad I did. But that's just something that with you, of course, there was never any concern with that. And as a matter of fact, like, it's a beautiful thing about jiu-jitsu and Nasara. It's like everyone seems to be so gracious and respectful. For you, though, like, it's clearly obvious that despite this decades-long background in fighting and having to go out and, you know, be aggressive and have the testosterone and the adrenaline, like, you've done a lot of work on yourself beyond the physical. And that's something that I think really draws people to you and just makes people want to be around you. Like, where did this come into your life? Like, when did you start doing the personal work, the deeper work beyond just the physical stuff in the gym?
That's a good question. Thank you for your kind words.
Anytime, dude.
Yeah, I mean, from the fighting standpoint of or just being, you know, the humility really came from getting my ass kicked. You know, I've beaten world champions and lost to guys with terrible records. You know, a fight is a fight. You can win any day. You can lose any day. And, you know, for whatever reason, some days you're not supposed to win. I truly believe that. You know, like the fight, the last kickboxing fight I had, you know, and the guy was a very talented fighter. But in my mind, you know, I'm going to beat him 99 times out of 100 in a kickboxing fight. Just everything was skewed in my favor. And for whatever reason, that night, I just wasn't there, wasn't in my body. After some reflection of the fight, and I wasn't supposed to win that fight. I was supposed to lose and lose in the fashion that I did. And so many lessons came from the losses. So many more lessons came from the losses than came from the wins. And, you know, I wasn't ever the tattooed, you know, I wasn't the guy that had tattoos and had the ego. Like, it just wasn't me. I ended up getting my first tattoo when I was like, you know, 42 years old and had a full sleeve within a year. But, you know, in the fight world, I was like an anomaly because I didn't, you know, I looked like a clean cut, average, you know, dude walking around, right? So I would be with these, you know, all of these energies and all of these egos but when you get down and you really, really talk to these guys or watch these guys and girls, because there were girl fighters too, like, there's so much, the fight is in your head. 99% of the fight is in your head before the fight starts, in your head while the fight's going on. You know, you can defeat yourself before you ever go in there. You can, from either not believing in yourself or being too overconfident, there definitely has to be a balance. And the true work really started when I moved here to Costa Rica. You know, I ended up doing a plant medicine ceremony with psilocybin with one of my buddies who I really for whatever reason, I just instantly trusted this guy and really looked up to him. And he asked me to come on this, to do this journey up at Finca Austria, where my wife and I got married on this beautiful mountain and here in Costa Rica. And I mean, I never smoked marijuana or a cigarette or anything in my life, right? I was pretty sheltered. But for some reason, I was like, yeah, I mean, I think it's time I want to do something like this. And I go, and it's this amazing shaman and his wife, and they're doing the psilocybin. And I mean, I kind of knew, you know, about mushrooms or whatever, but they're, you have basically one, you can take it once and it's like the actual mushrooms. And then if you want more, you can take more. So I took like maybe 2 or 3 grams the first time. And I always end up doing this. Stuff takes a while to hit me, and then it hits me and I'm done. But so I'm sitting there and kind of, you know, we're listening to music and it's beautiful, and I'm sitting around and you know, I'm not really feeling anything. So I go back up there, and there's this one mushroom that is like, I mean, it is giant. It's literally, it's the biggest mushroom I've ever seen. And for some reason, it just called to me, and I was like,
Terry, eat me. Eat me, Terry.
Yeah, take me, take me. So I get it. And my buddy, who was, he was kind of helping facilitate, he looks at me and he goes, bro, are you sure? I'm like, yep. So I take it. So I end up taking like 7 grams of mushrooms, having never done mushrooms before. And at one point, I mean, and for me, honestly, it was like a religious experience. I mean, I grew up, my dad was a Baptist minister. I grew up in church my whole life. Had kind of, you know, stepped away from church for a long time. And, you know, right before we moved here, I'd ended up working security for a church, and, you know, so spiritual, but kind of away from traditional religion. But I had this like religious experience. And at one point I sit up, you know, the sun is setting and it's beaming through this light, through this, you know, we're in a shala, like all wood, and these wood beams. It's a beautiful, huge ceiling, and the sun shining through this like triangle at the top. And I look up, and my buddy is coming towards me, and he's facilitating. So he's in all white. At the time, he has this like giant beard, bald head. He's in all white, and he's going around like putting his hands on people's shoulders and the head, asking them if they're okay. And he gets over to me, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, "Hey, buddy, are you all right?" And I look up at him, and I go, "Jesus." He goes, "Nope, not even close." Were you that out of it?
Was this legit?
Yeah, it wasn't even. It wasn't even. Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, I thought for a second. I mean, the experience. I'm glad that I did the experience the way that I did it, because I didn't like dabble in it.
Yeah.
It was enough to actually, say, take me to the other side, and see behind the curtain, so to speak, kind of like Oz, right? And when you see behind the curtain, so much so that I thought I wasn't coming back. Like, I thought that was reality. All this was, you know, just stories that were made up. I'm still not 100% sure that's not true, but that's for another time. So there was sadness because of my kids, and I'm like, oh, but you know, but I've seen the other side now, and this is real. And So, you know, I come out of it and I call my kids and make sure they're real or whatever, but it wasn't a scary experience. It was just more of an enlightening experience for me. And just started looking at things from a different lens, just a lot more. And I feel like I've always been, you know, the smiley guy, friendly guy, you know, whatever. Obviously, as a fighter, you had to be somebody different when you were in the cage or the ring or whatever. But never had malice or ill intent for my opponents. And but you know, once I moved here, went through that experience, I just started noticing how, you know, people reacted to certain things and felt compassion for why people were the way they were. So, you know, we're all, you know, in jiu-jitsu, we're all in there for different reasons. Most of it is, you know, for our own feeling of either being secure or being able to defend ourselves, or you know, it's the cool thing to do at the moment, or we enjoy the exercise piece, but there's so much that goes into it, right? And kind of like when I was teaching kids martial arts, like any one thing you say or do, or the effect you have on someone can have a major outcome or result for them in their life. Like that guy who cracked your ribs, you know, at that day, he, for whatever reason, it made his ego to feel good to squash 100 and whatever pound white belt. And that fed his ego. That made him feel good. I'm not saying it's right because it's not, but for you, that could have been, you know, that could have been the end of your jiu-jitsu tenure, and you know, then you and I probably wouldn't have met, and you know,
Yeah.
X, Y, and Z wouldn't have happened. And so I've grown to try to be more careful about how I treat people, the words I use, trying to be more compassionate and look at things through different lenses. And I've always been kind of a chameleon. Like I can hang out with anybody, talk to anybody, any walk of life, you know, no judgment. You know, I kind of get along with anybody and I try to make people laugh. And but really, the more I've done, really, the more I've done plant medicine and breath work and men's work and just really feeling like we're all kind of one big conscious and we can all feel each other's shoes in different ways depending on the day. So not trying to judge people because I might be wearing your shoes tomorrow.
And you know, I don't wear shoes often.
Or shirts.
Or shirts.
You and Jake.
I love like the trajectory of our relationship because we met in jiu-jitsu. We probably trained together for more than a year before we ever really had much of a conversation outside of jiu-jitsu. And then I set up an archery range on my property, which is really close to your retreat center. And of all the people that I could ask in jiu-jitsu and beyond, of all the friends in Nosara, for some reason, like you were the guy who I asked, "Do you like archery?" And literally, like that was the moment for us when I was like, "Yeah, let's go." And so we started doing archery like pretty much every day, which I love, and I love that you and I can go out there. In a good mood, in a bad mood. Generally, we're always in good moods, but you know, even when we're going through stuff, we can go out there and we might not even talk, but just being out there shooting together, it's just so grounding and meditating. It's therapeutic. And that's what archery has always been for me. There's this huge healing aspect to it, which is why I really got into traditional archery. I didn't want some high-tech gadget in my hands. I wanted to hold a piece of wood. And so from there, we ended up, through my wife, Bree, and her partner, Miranda, we ended up doing a heart medicine ceremony, an MDMA ceremony, at your retreat center, which was an incredible experience. We both had walked away with us so much from that. But the day after, during my integration, I'm doing archery alone, integrating, and I think I need to talk to Terry again because I'm going to start doing retreats, and I'm going to start doing retreats at his place. And I hadn't done it. I hadn't offered any men's retreats since leaving Canada almost 2 years ago. COVID ended up canceling a few of my retreats. So it actually had probably been like 2.5 years since I had done any. And you, of course, not only open to the idea, but you have this concept that's kind of been sitting on the shelf and waiting for life to be breathed into it, the balanced man. And so we ended up, what we're doing now is we're offering the balanced man's retreats. And the first one's in October. Tell me a bit about what the balanced man means to you and why this has been such an important concept that you've been holding on to and kind of slowly breathing life into.
Yeah, man. You know, the balanced man for me, and I wanted to do or had this calling to do something for men, with men. I feel like, and not that it's not needed, but I feel like there's so much stuff for women. You know, there's so many retreats and so many classes and so many seminars and so many different types of counseling and workshops and, you know, and for men, we just don't have the same community and tribes and things that women do. And, you know, I've went in different directions where, you know, I had one that was going to be like man up militia, and, you know, because of the fighting that I did and doing the Krav Maga and the military stuff, and like, just thought, you know, it's going to kind of be that sort of thing. And I had an epiphany one day that, you know, that there needs to be, you know, the truth is there needs to be balance in everything, right? The duality, it wouldn't have been the right timeline, but it's been echoed in a lot of my plant medicine journeys. I get the same messaging where, you know, there's always this duality of the masculine and the feminine and good and evil and you know, white and black and dark and light and so, but there needs to be balance, you know, especially for men. You know, you need to be strong, you need to be physically fit, you need to be able to defend yourself and defend your family. You know, you need to be a brother that other brothers can count on and depend on. And but at the same time, you need to be caring and you need to be empathetic you need to be a good leader, but you also need to know when it's time to follow. So I just feel like, or have felt like, that's missing, especially in today's society. And, you know, I moved here to NOSARA and, you know, there's a lot of great facilitators here in NOSARA. There's a lot of, great retreats and camps and seminars but a lot of the men's stuff that I was seeing is, you know, they're just doing just the internal work. And a lot of it's the same stuff, right? You know, you're talking about your feelings, great. You're, you know, setting intentions, you're having a bonfire on the beat. Like, all this stuff is great, but a lot of what I saw is these guys aren't really getting real world skills that they can take back home with them. You know, I'm not saying all of it was bad or anything like that, but I wanted guys because a lot of it is how you felt, how you feel about yourself, you know, for the years of, you know, I was the little kid in school, I was bullied, you know, I loved martial arts, but really the main reason that I started fighting was that little kid in me wanted to learn how to stand up for himself. And, you know, the more skills that I acquired and the better that I got at fighting and defending myself, the more confident that I became, in that, the more conversations, you know, I would have with people and the more outgoing that I got, and just then I got to where I could share that with other people and make them more confident and them, you know, have a good feeling about being able to defend themselves and step out there. And I just wanted to create something that, you know, that built that kind of balanced man. Like he's going to learn all the internal stuff, and work on himself on the mental side and the spiritual side, but then also be exposed to the self-defense and the Krav Maga and the jiu-jitsu and the training. He's going to learn, you know, we're going to shoot arrows and, you know, learn what that feels like to do instinctive archery, you know, to work with Casper, who's an amazing trainer and knows everything about the body. I mean, I was a personal trainer for 30 years and have taught people how to squat wrong my whole career, and been doing them wrong myself.
Casper and I actually talked about that, and when I interviewed him, because I overheard you saying that the other day when we were meeting, so I asked him about it. Yeah.
And then, you know, Jake with his open water stuff, because there's something every man, I think on the planet has things in his life that make him feel strong or make him feel good about himself. But then there's always something where he feels less than, or it's a, you know, weaker. Like for me, it's swimming. Like I'm so glad that I met Jake and he's got me, I learned to float on my back, for the first time in my life. So which makes me feel more comfortable when I am in the open water. Hopefully I'll get to a point where I feel comfortable enough to be able to surf in the green with my wife. But yeah, I want these guys to have skills that they can take back home with them that make them feel more complete and more balanced. And that's going to make them better fathers. That's going to make them better husbands. That's going to make them better friends. And then the other piece is, you know, I did this very popular, men's group thing for, it was like a 6-week program, and you know, it was good. It had some good stuff, and it was all about brotherhood and the tribe, and you're part of this, you know, thing. And at the end of it, it was, you know, if you still want to be in the brotherhood, it's going to cost, you know, $600 a month. And for me, that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, so I wanted to create something that guys, once, you know, you've come on the retreat, or once you're in, you're in, you're a lifer. Mm-hmm. Like you're going to have brothers that you can count on or talk to, or share stories with, or ask advice to, or, you know, whatever it is, forever. Because I think, you know, that's one of the worst things that can happen to a man, is for him to feel isolated and feel like he doesn't have brotherhood, he doesn't have community, and he's doing it on his own. I think COVID definitely exacerbated that. Yeah. Not just men, but with everybody.
And I want to stay on that for a second. I think it is so important for men to realize and to be aware that having these relationships of trust and complete honesty with other men is so damn important. And if you don't have those and you're in a relationship with a wife or a girlfriend and you're using her as the person who you need to emote to and who you need to speak to about all of these things, you're showing up in those situations more in your feminine energy and expecting her to hold the masculine, to hold that space for you, which is fine to do periodically. But if you don't have a brotherhood of men, you continue to turn to your partner and you continue to use her and rely on her to hold space for you, you're not doing yourself any favors in the relationship. And having men to be there to have your back, it's a game changer. And men who haven't experienced that before, please come join us at the retreat, because it is something that once you do that, once you develop that brotherhood of men, and these aren't the buddies that you've drank with your whole life or you played ball with your whole life. It could be that as well, but like these are connections that are at a very, very different level where there is complete safety in sharing your deepest, darkest fears and secrets and weaknesses or whatever it is that you've been holding on to that you don't feel safe and letting out. Like once you find a group of men like this, anything's safe and everything's going to be received with empathy and compassion and grace. And it's that alone, like it makes opportunities like this just priceless, absolutely priceless.
Yeah, I agree for sure. So yeah, that's why I created. It was so funny that, you know, I had this balanced man. I mean, I had the website, I'd done all this work for it. And then I just kind of put it on the shelf. I think a part of me, I just didn't want to do it by myself. I knew that it could be bigger and better and a more impactful program if I had other brothers to do it with, you know. And like I said, there's so many great facilitators here. You know, it started with you, and then they're like, oh, we're going to talk to this person, and this person came to mind, and you know, they jumped on board, and now we have something in my mind that is epic, that is helping men, teaching them skills that who knows if are going to become more and more prevalent. I think the self-defense, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, more people need to be able to defend themselves, defend their family. I think it's important for the network of the relationship of especially the male and the female, of her being able to count on you if something happens, that or to feel like that you can defend her, that you can defend your kids or your family. But the balance of being able to do that and at the same time holding space for the feminine. I'm reading this while I'm listening to this book, The Way of the Superior Man, right now. And so like good. A lot of it was like super eye-opening for me, because all this masculine stuff that I thought I was doing, or I think that's masculine, is actually the feminine.
Exactly. Like,
wait, what?
Exactly. Flips it. I mean,
when
head.
I get pissed and I throw shit and slam the door, that's feminine? Seems so masculine.
I had the same response the first time I read it. I was like, oh shit, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. I want to expound on the things that we are doing on the retreat. You know, I want to learn more stuff myself and then have other offerings of things that we're teaching, like, you know, how to build a fire out of nothing, or you know, navigate or read a compass, or, you know, there's all these things that in my eyes are manly things that men should know.
Yeah.
How to do. At the same time, learning them with other guys and building this tribe and building this community that we hope gets bigger and bigger and bigger, You know, so that we do have a community of like-minded individuals that we can call upon or count on in times of need.
Yeah. I'm excited for the retreats after the October one that we'll put together, because each of them is going to have a pretty unique theme and approach to it. And I think we're going to be able to help a lot of people. And I like too that we are doing the adventures. We are using those as tools for camaraderie and personal growth, but we're also taking the downtime to do some really deep internal work. And so it's going to be a nice mix. We also have two amazing women who are going to be holding some ceremonial space, who have held space for us. And it's like game changing. It's Bri and Miranda, and it's going to be an amazing week. And yeah, I'm so like honored to be working with you and the rest of the guys and the girls. It's going to be amazing. And we get to do it at Casa's Kismet. Your place is like one of the most beautiful places on earth, man. It
Thanks,
is
bro.
nuts. Like, can you like take a few minutes? Like, I wanna you went from having a some gyms in Knoxville to then taking this like huge plunge and buying a retreat center in Costa Rica. Like, how did this come up?
You know, I came to Costa Rica the first time at the in very, very end of 2016. I came for like New Year's. It was so it had been the end of 2016, beginning of 2017. I came with a couple of buddies that wanted to come and surf. I'd never heard of Nusa Costa Rica. We came down, had a great time. I loved it. And then they wanted to come back the next year. And I said, yeah, I can come, but I have to train. I was like getting ready for a jiu-jitsu tournament. I was big into a tournament jiu-jitsu, IBJJF scene then. And it was the Atlanta Open, I think. And I was just 2 weeks out. So I was like, I'm going to come down there, but I have to train. So we came down. And I kept seeing these signs for Jungle's Edge, and it was jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai, and you know, but it's a tiny town, and I'm like, where is this place? But it's, you know, from living here, the signs are never like close to where the actual thing is.
That's not what
So
signs are for.
So my buddy, we're at Tenpai's, and he sees like a sticker for the Jiu-Jitsu Athletic Advance at the
It's
time,
not Ten Pies, dude. It's DSPS.
whatever, and it's Pete's place, and he says, hey man, here's where the Jiu-Jitsu guy, and he asks, and it's Oscar that's working.
Yeah.
The Diaz brothers, Oscar and Ramon, actually picked me up the next morning at the hotel we were staying at and took me to Jungle's Edge. And
I love those two guys.
yeah,
Shout out to Oscar and Ramon.
trained there, and the owner of the retreat was at a retreat center, and the owner was there, encouraged me to come and do retreats. He found out I had Krav Maga Studios, and he said, oh, you should come back and bring your people and do a retreat. And there was the Muay Thai guy was there, Sean Fagan. And he had like 40 people on a retreat. So I started doing the math and the numbers, and I'm like, man, this is getting, you're going to make a lot of money doing something that you love to do in a place you love to be. I'm like, this is it. I'm going to try this out. So I went back home, and the first retreat, I had like three people. And then the next one, I had nine people. And the next one, I had 12. You know, it just kept growing. And one of the clients that came trained at my gym, you know, said that they wanted to invest and maybe buy a retreat center, have me do retreats, and that's kind of how it started. I actually, my now wife came on one of those retreats, and we started dating. The investor ended up falling through. I kept going and kept looking for other investors. And then her parents said, "Oh, we might be interested in investing. We've never been to Costa Rica, but we'd like to come down and check it out." So they came down. I looked at properties here for like a year and a half, and the very first place I looked at was literally right next door to where I'm at.
Oh, wow.
And for whatever reason, we couldn't come in to see this property that day. And a year and a half later, I came onto the balcony of the penthouse and was like, "This is it." Just had an energy to it. And then her parents came down and we ended up purchasing it in November of 2019. And then this really weird thing happened in
Dun dun
2020 that
dun.
nobody talks about. And we had to, so we bought it and then COVID happened and we had to leave the country for 8 months. They closed the border and we had to leave the country for 8 months and it sat here empty. I had actually a camera installed right at the pool and I would just look on the camera and just every once in a while I'd see the cleaning lady and
Occasional Jaguar walkthrough.
and then so when it opened back up in October, was it would have been October 2020, I came down and then we decided to sell everything and move. We were going to get stuck. We wanted to get stuck here. And then so that was crazy times, owning a couple of gyms, and a retreat center in another country I couldn't get to in 2020. So I also got married November 30th of 2020. So that was fun times. But yeah, man, it was the best decision that I've made. Was super blessed in a lot of ways to end up with this place to be able to live here and all the people that come and do retreats and it is a magical place.
It is that for sure. Such a big move, and it takes some serious guts and commitment to like pull the trigger on that, and then to sell your gyms and like go all in in this new venture. When you're no longer a young whippersnapper like you used to be, man, it's
Just said I was so young, like 10 minutes ago. You said you're young now.
not a wet.
You're a fire.
I'm messing with you. Messing with you. No, but it's amazing. And like way to go. And it's to the benefit of so many people now. It's such an incredible space for us to enjoy and heal. It's such a healing space.
Yeah, I agree. It really, really has. Like I said, it has great energy. It was like a nudist colony before for these like 7 year olds. Maybe that's it.
That's your future, dude.
Yeah, right? I mean, but yeah, I think with we're doing our retreat. My wife's now doing like these surf yoga adventure retreats. Of course we have, yoga all the time here, which I think is beneficial too. But definitely there needs to be a balance of the masculine and the feminine. Otherwise there's going to be chaos.
Yeah. One, I don't know if it's a last question, but nearing the end. For your balance, obviously you've got a pretty rigorous physical routine. You're training every day in multiple disciplines. What do you do to balance that out with your mental, emotional? Are there any routines that you have during the day that are not based on the physical?
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten more into reading. I will play the piano sometimes. I learned to play the piano when I was younger
A
and not
renaissance man.
yeah, not good by any means, but it's soothing for me. It surprises a lot of people that I can play the piano. It's like a party trick. Hey, what's this?
Watch the big guy. Watch him go sit down and play the piano.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and like I said, I've gotten more into breath work. I think it's super important. But and it can't be and it can't be all physical. There definitely has to be some mental practices. I actually was doing did a holotropic breath work with no medicine retreat, which I just did a day of it, and to be 100% honest, I thought it was going to be bullshit, right? I was like, if we're not doing any medicine, I'm not going on any journeys. But it was super, super powerful, man. During that experience, I did have this epiphany that I've worked so hard on the physical body and the physical presence, and this next stage or whatever it is, I need to start working on the inside more and doing a lot more inner work and taking care of my body and do more yoga and do more breath work and qigong or whatever it is. But that's going to be super important.
Yeah. Oh, and I love too that like some of the stuff that we're incorporating into the retreat, despite being physical, the archery and the surfing and even the self-defense, those can be deeply meditative. And the right with the right intention doing those things is definitely therapy on its own and not just the physical exercise. It really can help us do deep personal work, which is really first and foremost why I got into archery. I just felt this deep inner calling to pick up a traditional bow, a piece of wood, and use that in such a masculine and powerful way.
Yeah, that's how I was with martial arts, man. I don't know, believe whatever you believe. I mean, I tend to believe this isn't the first time I've been here, sort of thing. So I think I've been doing martial arts for a really, really long time, and it just resonates with me. I love all combat sports. That was the reason for the TV show. It was the reason I, first started, kicking stuff in the backyard and joining the ATA Taekwondo school and everything that's happened since then.
Yeah.
I think there's just certain things that, and there's probably people out there that would be amazing at whatever it is, and they just never try it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sitting down and having this chat with me, brother. I miss you. Next
Yeah,
time,
brother.
we'll be on the archery range. Website for the retreat is thebalanceman.life for anyone who wants more information. Do you have another any personal sites or anywhere you want to send people to find more about you?
No, I mean, they can find me on Instagram, Facebook. Those are all going to be just at Terry Bowman. But yeah, man, the I'm really excited for this first group of guys coming on this retreat. I think it's going to be great. I think it's just a start.
Yep, it is a beautiful start. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, man. Love you.
Love
See
you
you soon.
too. Thanks for listening to this episode of Salish Wolf with Terry Bowman. If you want to learn more from Terry, please join the Balanced Man community by attending one of our Costa Rica-based retreats or joining our online program. Go to thebalancedman.life for more information. Please check out anchorpointexpeditions.com for all episodes of this podcast and for information on my men's leadership retreats, men's group, and personal development coaching. This show was produced by me, Todd Howard. Music was written and performed by Jason Kaus of the Darcys. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you are using and share it with your friends and family. If there is a guest you would like to recommend for the show, please email discover@anchorpointexpeditions.com. You have been listening to Salish Wolf. I am Todd Howard, signing off.